Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Eric Schwartzel. He works for the Wall Street Journal. He writes, covers the film industry, and he is out with a brand new book called Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. The book's available everywhere, and it is an amazing tale to read. And Eric, as I read your book, I kept in mind, when I was growing up, the hot celebrity couple in the early 90s was Julia Roberts and Lyle Lovett. And I remember people thinking, what in the world does he see in her? And then sometimes you see this Pamela and Tommy Lee get together, and, you know, how do these two match? There's certain relationships we don't understand. China and Hollywood, not necessarily a match made in heaven, but what do they have that each other wants?
Wow, what an analogy. I love that. You're absolutely right. Yes, what would America's most famous sort of consumerist export have to do with a communist regime that until the late 20th century was largely shut off to the rest of the world? Great question. So it starts in the mid-90s when China's economy is rapidly modernizing and opening itself up to the world. And so we're starting to see companies like Boeing and tech companies move into China, and Hollywood does the same thing. They start sending movies into Chinese theaters. And over the next 20 years, as China's economy grows at a clip, its box office also grows, and soon it has more theaters than any country in the world and a bigger box office than any country in the world. So, frankly, for Hollywood, it becomes too big to ignore. And at the same time, ticket sales in the U.S. start to flatline. And movie going in the U.S. doesn't exactly fade from popularity, but it stagnates just as China is growing. And so China ends up having enormous economic leverage over Hollywood and really has dictated what movies get made and what movies don't get made over the past decade.
The question in my mind as I started the book was, why doesn't China just develop its own Hollywood? They make everything else. They can build a hospital in a month. They can build infrastructure like Who Laid the Rails. Why don't they just have their own Hollywood there and treat it like Hollywood treats it its own in the United States?
Well, and I think that is where things are going here. Because as China's box office was growing and Hollywood was paying more and more attention to it, a concurrent phenomenon was happening where China's movie industry, which until the really early 2000s was largely a propagandistic arm of the government, China's film industry grew more and more sophisticated. And what we're seeing is, frankly, the cinematic version of what happens to a lot of American businesses that go over to China, where China observes how the work is done and then tries to make a Chinese version of it. There's a dialectic in China that roughly translates to use the West for its tools, but keep China as the essence. And today, it is not uncommon for a Chinese movie to come out in that country and gross $600, $700, $800 million. And they're movies that most Americans have largely never heard of and will never see, but they are making more than any movie released anywhere in the world right now.
It's interesting to read in your book the idea that this whole Disney thing with China, and I was fascinated by the story of Disney wanting to open the Shanghai Disney World. And can you recount that story? Because I thought it was really a testament to how things get built in China versus the United States.
Absolutely. You know, the Shanghai Disneyland, which opened in 2015, was really almost 20 years in the making. And back in the mid-90s, Disney knew, I mean, it didn't take a Harvard MBA to realize this was a market to pay attention to, and Disney knew that it would eventually justify building a theme park there. However, even back in the mid-90s, Chinese officials pressured Disney executives to build one earlier than they wanted, because for the Chinese officials, you know, there's no emblem of economic progress more powerful than a Disney theme park in mainland China only, you know, 20 years after the Cultural Revolution. However, Disney has a playbook, and they know they cannot just build a theme park overnight as you might in China. They have to seed affection for their characters with children, or otherwise they're not going to beg their parents to take them to that park. And so it took many, many years, but through movies, through toys, and through actually a series of English language schools, Disney started to introduce its characters to Chinese children who had been largely shut off from Western culture in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
One of the big movies when I was growing up was Red Dawn, and that played an important role in the book. So can you explain how the Chinese influence made that remake just suck?
Yeah, sure. Well said. I mean, get to the point. I think that, you know, you're right. In the original Red Dawn, which a lot of people remember as this kind of, like, this ultimate case study in what I call rah-rah cinema, right? It's about vigilante teenagers taking on Soviet bad guys who invade the U.S. MGM wanted to remake the movie in 2009. However, it doesn't make any sense to have Russia as an invading force at that time. So they said, we'll remake it, but we'll have China as the invader. Well, when Chinese authorities heard about this, they made it very clear, mostly through state media, that this is not what they wanted to see on the screen. And they started to threaten, through these articles, MGM and its business in China. However, MGM was really in a bind because the movie had already been filmed. And so what they had to do is, before it was released, they had to pay a visual effects firm $1 million to go in and methodically, frame by frame, change the images and the dialogue so that it was not a Chinese invasion of the U.S., but a North Korean one. And as you said, you know, many people thought the movie ended up sucking because a North Korean invasion of the U.S. was A, not plausible, and B, it took this scenario that actually was reflective of the cultural moment we were in. You know, China's power was rising, and there was a lot of anxiety around Americans about what its plans were for the next century, and instead just shoehorned this kind of illogical North Korean replacement, and the movie kind of came and went. But it had a real looming effect in Hollywood because since then, and it's been a decade, since then, no Hollywood film has been put into production with China cast as the villain.
I'm chatting with Eric Schwartzel about his brand new book, Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. It is available everywhere, and it's a fascinating read. For a nonfiction book, this thing read like a thriller, Eric. And, you know, as I delve back into this book, you see this whole idea of the Hollywood blacklist. And, I mean, that's a thing from the 50s that is now coming back as it relates to China. But does Hollywood itself see itself as a weaker link in this relationship? Because it seems like China controls a lot of Hollywood, but Hollywood doesn't control a lot of China. It seems like Hollywood is the weaker spouse here.
Yeah, it's really asymmetrical. You're absolutely right. And it's gotten to be even more so in the past 6 to 8 months because Chinese authorities who have to approve the release of every Hollywood movie before they can show in Chinese theaters have just flat out rejected the release of many big movies from the past year. I'm talking about like Black Widow and even that new Spider-Man movie, which made $1 billion worldwide. You know, these movies are not playing in Chinese theaters, and no one really knows why. And there's no real recourse on Hollywood's part. And so I think talking to folks here in the industry, there's a real sense of frustration. And as one person put it, you know, a real sense of getting played, of rush, you know, over the past decade and a half, rushing toward that Chinese revenue and the Chinese box office, only to find that whenever the table turned, there was nothing that Hollywood could really control.
There's an old adage that vice presidents just go to funerals, and it's the worst job in the world. But President Joe Biden, while he was President Obama's vice president, played a certain role in this relationship between China and Hollywood. What was that? How did that come about?
Yeah, it was back in 2012, and you're right, yeah, Joe Biden was then vice president, and he was meeting in Los Angeles with Xi Jinping, who was not yet president of China, but was the clear heir apparent. And until that time, Hollywood had been sending movies to China. There were occasional breakout hits like Avatar, but it was very clear that over the next decade, there would be a lot more money to be made. And so the studios successfully lobbied then-Vice President Biden to expand what they call the quota, which is the number of movies allowed into China from outside countries. And they jumped from 20 movies a year to 34. And this all but guaranteed that every major blockbuster in Hollywood could get in. If the authorities allowed it, there was room for them all. And it really greatly expanded the number of films each studio would get in and therefore the amount of money that each studio could count on making in China. And this was negotiated by Vice President Biden, you know, sort of in a hastily arranged meeting with Xi Jinping while he was visiting the U.S. It was actually, I'd be remiss if I didn't say, it was the same trip that Xi Jinping returned to Iowa on. He went to Muscatine, Iowa, a town, as I'm sure you know, he spent some time in as a young man. On that same trip in 2012, he negotiated the deal that really would make Hollywood much more reliant on his country.
Is Hollywood dead without China?
I don't think it's dead, but it has to get more creative without it, because the business plans that studios are using today rely very heavily on China. I mean, think of it this way. When you are a studio chief approving the production of a $250 million movie, you feel a lot better about taking on that risk if you know it will be released in China and make some money there. And now that that has been thrown into question over the past year, that decision gets a lot harder. But at the same time, every studio, especially since COVID struck, has been focusing more and more on streaming, which is a model that relies far less on China. In fact, doesn't really need China at all. So there's a bit of a bifurcation happening where the big theatrical releases are still going to really hope against hope that they get released into China. But the streaming model, which relies on subscriptions, needs it far less.
You interviewed a whole lot of people for this book and people with connections to the Chinese government. What did you find as far as the readiness of people to talk? Was this one of the most covert things you've had to investigate?
There were moments where it had to be really sensitive, where I would get phone calls from China, and we would have these really kind of like coded and opaque conversations where we wouldn't mention certain things because, you know, sometimes, indeed, when you do, a call will suddenly get dropped. There were certainly sensitivities there. I will also say, though, that traveling in China and reporting in China, I was struck by the real sense of pride that a lot of people in the Chinese film industry had for what they've just managed to accomplish. I mean, they really have built a robust and competitive film industry in about a decade and a half that it took Hollywood about a century to do.
Well, if HBO ever wants to make a movie out of this book, I doubt they'll get any Chinese money to do it. Am I right?
Yeah, that's going to be a little tricky. Yeah, there's a couple tripwires there, I think, when it comes to maintaining access to the market. You know, so I don't know whether or not I should be happy or sad about that, because on one hand, it might deprive an opportunity to see a film version of this, but on the other, it does confirm my thesis.
All right. The book is Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy by Eric Schwartzel of the Wall Street Journal. Read him in the Wall Street Journal. He's a great writer, and this book is just fantastic. Eric, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book, but I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.